Good morning. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect, it is 9:06 a.m. on Thursday, May 13th, 2021. Present in the room today are Representative Thompson, Representative Lavon, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Rasmussen, Vice Chair Ortiz, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. This morning, we will hear public testimony and consider amendments to House Bill 157 by Representative Rasmussen, APOC Report Referenda Recall Contributor. Representative Rasmussen, do you have comments before we open public testimony? Okay, with that, I will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room or online that would care to testify on House Bill 157? Seeing no one, I will close public testimony. Amendments to House Bill 157 were due to my office on Wednesday, May 5th. There are two amendments before the committee, which you should have received Tuesday evening. First, amendment number one. Let the record reflect we are joined by Representative Carpenter at 9:07 a.m. Amendment number one by Representative Rasmussen. Do you have a motion?
Madam Co-Chair, I move amendment number one.
Is there an objection? Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Amendment number one is just some cleanup language to allow for APOC to run more efficiently and find some cost savings. It does not modify any of the existing language in House Bill 157. It does remove a requirement for the APOC office to be located in each Senate district. It removes the word all from the phrase examine, investigate, and compare report statements and actions required by this chapter. It clarifies that contributions and expenditures are in a calendar year instead of being left open-ended. It makes requests for advisory opinions to be returned within 7 business days instead of 7 calendar days, giving the APOC personnel a little bit more time to work through those reports. Provides for publication of reports and archives of statements and reports to be posted on their website, as well as have copies available at the central office. This also repeals the duplicative reporting requirements with respect to ballot initiative groups. The same language can be found in Alaska Statute 15-13-040 version K and 15-13-110G. And I believe that Executive Director Hebden is available for any technical question on how this could impact APOC operations.
Yes, we do have her online. We have a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Question for Representative bringing forward the amendment. You talked about how part of the amendment removes the requirement for APOC to have a office in each of the Senate districts. Under the current situation, does APOC have an office in each of the Senate districts right now as we speak?
Through the chair, it currently does not, and this is just kind of a cleanup for us so that we're able to comply with the statutes.
And just follow up?
Yes, follow up.
And do you know, by chance, how many APOC offices there are? In other words, how many districts are currently not covered?
Through the chair, I would defer to Ms. Hebden for that.
Good morning, Ms. Hebden. Could you please place yourself on the record and help Representative Ortiz with his question?
Yes, good morning. This is Heather Hebden. I'm the Executive Director with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Representative Ortiz through the chair. Currently, we have a small satellite office in Juneau, and we've got our main office here in Anchorage.
And just as a follow-up, and that's the way it's been for a number of years. Is that correct, Ms. Hebden?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes. I don't know specifically how long, but yes, for quite some time.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hebden. We have a question from Representative Wool.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So if there's this amendment says establish a central office, so I assume that means you would close the Juneau office, and would that result in the loss of PCN and any loss of functionality?
Ms. Hebden?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that was not what staff anticipated with this change. We do not anticipate closing the Juneau office or the loss of a PCN.
Follow up?
Thank you. I'm just reading the text of the amendment. The commission shall establish a central office. So I'm assuming now you have an Anchorage office, which is your primary office, and you said a satellite office in Juneau. But if a central office, does that mean, how do you interpret that?
Through the chair, Representative Wu, we would interpret it as our central office here in Anchorage, but we don't interpret it to require that we only have a single location.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions regarding Amendment 1? Seeing none, Representative Rasmussen.
I guess I would ask for your support on Amendment Number 1. It was brought forward by members of the Judiciary Committee after the Judiciary referral was waived and the bill was moved to Finance.
Thank you. Representative Wolf?
I'll remove my objection.
Thank you. Anything further? Seeing none, Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. Amendment Number 2 by Representative Josephson. Representative Josephson, do you have a motion?
I do. I move Amendment Number 2.
I'll object for the purpose of discussion. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. First, let me say, because this is how I would feel if it were my bill, that I'm very, very likely to vote for this bill on the floor. I may co-sponsor this bill. I think this is a good bill. But I wanted to raise an issue that my office flagged, actually, relative to this bill. So what we have in Alaska is we have a $500 limit on individual contributions to campaigns. And this was litigated in the 2017 to 2018 timeframe. I have an article here called Judges Open Door Wider for Out-of-State Money in Alaska Elections. But they affirmed the $500 per person limit on campaigns, regular campaigns. And this is by James Brooks, November 27th, 2018. One concern that was flagged in the bill is that the $500 limit would not apply to recall applications. So a well-funded, well-financed person out of state could decide to come after somebody. And we have seen, and I've said, both in defense of the governor to some degree and in defense of an assemblyman that represents me, that recall is a new budding frontier, in my opinion, in troublemaking. I think that some, not all, but some of the four allegations against the governor were dubious. One in my mind was not. And I think in the event of my assemblyman, he was forced to go through a recall because as chair, there were 17 people in the assembly hall instead of the allowed 15. And that was in this large room, and that was seen as a violation of law sufficient to cause a recall campaign. So what the amendment would do, and if you look at, the key word is on line 22 and 23, the key words, is it would say that that the spending limits that don't apply to propositions, and the reason those are different is propositions are ideas, recalls are people, and we believe, consistent with Citizens United, it's okay to limit direct donations involving people from individuals. So what this does, after all that, is to say, let's do the same $500 limit on recall campaigns at the signature stage as we do in our regular campaigns. Thank you.
Questions regarding Amendment Number 2? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? Seeing none, Amendment Number 2 has been adopted. Is there any other discussion on House Bill 157? Seeing none, Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 157, version 32-LS0667/A from committee as amended, with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 157 is moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Next is House Bill 85 by Representative LeBond by request, Financial Institutions Liability. Representative LeBond, you have comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would like to summarize the bill by this simple word, parity. It balances the relationship, the legal relationship as banks in the state, both national and state chartered. There's two different charters that a bank can seek, national and state. The Alaska Bankers Association, which is made up of the seven banks, some state chartered and some national chartered, are all in agreement with this bill. They've supported it. The Alaska Division of Banking has supported it, and the DEC has weighed in and supports it. So I urge committee approval. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative LeBond. Further discussion? Seeing none, Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 85, version 32-LS0371-G from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Thank you. Is there an objection? Seeing none, House Bill 85 is moved from committee. This concludes our agenda for this morning. Our next meeting is this afternoon at 1:30. Where we will consider House Bill 90, Vehicle Rentals and Vehicle Rental Networks, and the administration's employer contribution to PERS bill. So with that, at 9:24 a.m., we are adjourned. Thank you. Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect it is 3:15 p.m. on Thursday, March 13, 2021. Present in the room today are Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, Representative Wohl, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. This afternoon, we will hear an introduction of House Bill 90 and Senate Bill 55. I believe it is House Bill 55 and Senate Bill 90. No? Okay, House Bill 90 is Vehicle Rentals and Vehicle Rental Networks by Representative Wohl. My apologies. Representative, if you and your staff would put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the House Finance Committee. My name is Adam Wohl, Representative District 5 in Fairbanks. Alongside me is my staff member, Ashley Carrick, who will present the slideshow.
Thank you, and let the record reflect at 3:16 p.m. we were joined by Representatives Johnson and Thompson. Thank you, Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. HB 90, as you see in front of you, is Private Vehicle Rental Networks. What this bill strives to do is to apply the same statewide vehicle rental tax that's currently in place for rental cars when you rent a car, say, at the Anchorage International Airport from one of the many rental car companies. We'll apply that same tax rate to a peer-to-peer rental network. There are many of them. A popular one is called Turo, but this bill is not specifically towards Turo, but I will sometimes use that name because it is a popular one, much like Uber is popular in the TNC, Transportation Network Companies. So basically, a peer-to-peer rental is if a private individual owns a car and wishes to rent it to another private individual, they put it on a platform, a technology platform, and when you're searching for rental cars, and it can be on the internet, and often when you do search for rental cars on the internet, you'll see Hertz, Avis, National, and you'll see Turo on the same listing as well. The only difference is Turo does not use a brick and mortar shop. It does not have employees. Much like Uber, you are renting the car from an individual. You pay through the app. You don't pay the individual directly. And then the individual gets a share of that money from the company that runs the app, and the company keeps the other share of the money. So what this bill will do is add a tax, a statewide tax. So during that same transaction that the person rents the car from the individual, they will also pay a tax to the state. That will be a line item on the rental car bill. The owner of the car doesn't pay the tax. Turo does not pay the tax, but the person renting the car pays the tax. This is a level playing field bill. It treats all rental companies the same. By the way, the municipality of Anchorage has recently passed a law adding rental network tax to their already existing municipal rental tax. So when you rent a car in Anchorage, you pay the state tax and you pay a municipal tax of 8%. The state tax is 10%. So this would apply the same tax. Anchorage did it for the city. I'd like to do it for the state. It already happens for entities such as Airbnb that is prevalent everywhere in the world, I believe. And we don't have a bed tax, a statewide bed tax in Alaska, but we have municipal bed taxes. So in my hometown of Fairbanks, for example, if an individual has Airbnb, they must pay the bed tax that a hotel would pay. The Airbnb customer, owner, would have to also pay that same bed tax to the municipality, and they charge that bed tax to the person renting the room. They pay the same rate as the bed tax would be paid by a hotel. Uber law that was passed recently, a few years ago in this state, allows Uber to practice. And in cities where there's a sales tax, such as Juneau, the person renting the Uber will pay that city sales tax much like someone renting a taxi cab. No difference. It's a level playing field, same with the rental car bills. 29 states currently apply taxes to peer-to-peer car rentals. As I said earlier, Turo doesn't pay the tax. The person renting the car pays the tax. So it's not a cost to the owner of the car. It's not a cost to the platform owner, Turo. And just a little aside, some of these cars are owned by private individuals that have an extra car, or they're out of town, they're not using their car, and so on and so forth. Many people that put their cars up on these platforms are people that own multiple cars. And I know individuals in my hometown that do this. They'll go out and buy three or four very new cars, list them on Turo, and then rent them out. And they're sort of their own rental car companies. These are people making not just a little weekend money, but making serious money renting cars. And it, just recently we looked on the listings in Anchorage for rental cars, and there is a rental car shortage right now. And there was, I believe, maybe 14 Turo listings, and more than half of the listings were owners that had more than one car listed. So a lot of people are listing multiple cars on Turo, meaning they own multiple cars. So this is their business. And that's fine, but as a business owner, they should, and again, the tax gets passed on to the renter. But I believe that since we have a statewide rental tax, we should also have a statewide peer-to-peer rental network tax. And that's what this bill attempts to do.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Wohl, first question, you said that there are 14 cars listed on Turo in Anchorage. So I'm wondering how you get to the figure of 10 to 30% increase in total vehicle tax with such a small collection of folks in the peer-to-peer market.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this is just a one-day snapshot on this particular day. I would have to do a more thorough analysis over the course of the year. It's a slow tourist season right now. I'm sure there's more than 14 cars because in the years past, I've also looked for listings, Turo listings on Anchorage or other Alaskan locations, and there's a lot of them. In fact, we had a testifier in this committee a couple years ago, and I forget, they suspect there's thousands or hundreds of cars online in Alaska rented by Turo, but I don't have that fact exactly. This is just a today snapshot. They found 14 cars, of which eight of the listings out of the 14, when you clicked on the owner, that same owner had more than one listing.
Follow up?
You said, through the chair, you said that the municipality of Anchorage has an 8% tax now on these vehicle rental networks.
Yes.
And to that, you want to add 10%, making it a total of 18%?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the state rental tax right now, statewide, is 10%. Anchorage has its own vehicle rental tax of 8%. So if you currently rent an Avis or a Hertz in the city of Anchorage, you already are paying 10 plus 8% in rental tax. But if you rent a Turo in Anchorage, currently you are paying 10 plus 8%. The municipality of Anchorage added the 8% that they currently have for regular rental cars. They just added that to Turo. Now, the statewide does not have that 10%. So if you rent a car in Wasilla, you pay 0% right now.
Representative Josephson.
Last question, I guess, through the chair. I'm in the happy position of being totally indifferent about this industry. But what do you do to the price and its business model? That is, I assume someone's trying to make money. That's why they're loaning their or renting out their cars. What do you do to that business model with your bill?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I just believe that, let's say a car is renting for $100. This bill would cause that rental rate to be $110. That extra $10 would go to the renter. So I guess if I'm the renter, I could say, wow, the price of my car just went up 10%. But it puts me on a level playing field of renting a car either in the municipality of Anchorage. Well, no, I'm sorry, I take that back, because Anchorage currently doesn't have the statewide 10%, but it has the municipal 8%. But it puts me on a level playing field with renting a car from any other rental provider, the traditional brick and mortar rental providers. Does it raise the price of the rental to the person renting? Yes, because now they have to pay the state tax where they didn't have to. But if I rent from Hertz or Avis or any of the other ones, I would have to pay that. So it just makes the rental rate equal.
I'm sorry,
yes, follow up.
I guess my question is, at some point, so I use Airbnb on occasion. I do it because it's less expensive than a hotel, generally. Sometimes it's just interesting. But at some point, with this new tax, am I going to just say, why am I messing with this? I'm just going to go to Avis. That's my question.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, what someone decides to rent their car for on Truro, I don't know what they base it on. It's probably what the market will bear. We had a caller during last year's testimony who rents cars on Truro, but he had kind of a nice car, so we rented it for a fair amount of money. I think whatever the market will bear. Are Truro cars necessarily cheaper? I don't know. They could be. I'll tell you this. They don't have employees. They don't have rent. There's a lot of expenses they don't have. They don't pay work comp, whereas a traditional brick and mortar will have these added expenses. So could they absorb that 10% and just lower their rate a little bit and keep it the same? Probably, and maybe they will. I know Airbnb tends to be cheaper than a hotel. Turo, some are probably cheaper and some are probably not, depending on the car, and I haven't really done a full analysis of that industry.
Thank you. We'd like the record to reflect at 3:22 p.m. we were joined by Representative Lebon, Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Kind of similar line of questioning as Rep. Josephson, I guess. I just wanted to note that some of the communication I've gotten on this, one being from one of the companies, that individual residents of Alaska, this is how the program works. They choose to make their car available through a platform. These hosts pay all associated costs for the maintenance of their vehicle, but the platform does provide liability when the vehicle is being shared. I think that the big difference here is that individual Alaskans aren't Enterprise or Hertz or Avis. I mean, they may own it, but for some of these people, I mean, one person emailed and said, I don't think very many of you are having to lease your vehicles to afford baby food and diapers. So taking 10%, if it's a $100 rental and they have to bring it down to 90, I mean, $10 doesn't get you very far when you have to buy diapers, and I can testify to that. A lot of these are kind of more referred to as mom and pop businesses, and I think that as we've learned from our friend the banker, there's a difference between a bank and a credit union, and I think that there's a difference between a private peer-to-peer rental and a rental car company. They're two different things, different business models.
Sure, I don't argue that, but through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, the customer pays the tax. The mom that can't afford the diapers is not paying the tax. So it's a line item on the bill, same as a line item on a traditional rental car. There are many individuals that own many multiple cars and rent them on Turo. There's many that are not mom and pop. I got to pay my rent this month. I'm going to rent out my Buick. Most of them are people that have nice cars that maybe take a loan to buy a specific nice car just to put it on Turo. It's not their day-to-day driver. In fact, to be on Turo, you have to have a fairly new car. It has to be in nice condition. It can't be, you know, the beater you drive around town with a bunch of trash in the back. It's got to be a nice car. It's got to be approved by Turo. And many of the owners are not individuals just trying to make the rent. And the tax is paid by the renter. It's not paid by the owner of the car. It's not paid by Turo. The same tax that you would have to pay on renting any other car. And like I said, Anchorage already implemented this tax for Turo. So the same car owners in Anchorage are already experiencing an 8% tax that their renters are paying.
Yes, follow up.
I understand that the renter is ultimately the one who pays, but as somebody who has rented cars and stayed in Airbnb, I look for the price. And in order for these people to compete, it may mean that they either have to lower their price, which does cut into the amount of money that they have for diapers, if that's one of the income streams that they have, to be able to compete with a rental car company, or if they don't drop their price, they lose the renter to a rental car company where they can get it cheaper. And it's, I mean, I think it's unfortunate if we don't think about the unintended consequences here, that these are different business models and the expenses are just different. So,
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, if we show the slideshow, you may be answering some of these questions. Also, the tax is already in place with the rental car company. So you say, well, the rental car company is going to be cheaper, but the tax is already included when you rent from a rental car company. So I don't think the tax is going to make the Turo more expensive, since it already doesn't have the tax that the rental car company does have. And I would suggest that the business model of a private owner is less onerous than the business model of a company with employees and rent and so on and so forth. But if we could show the slideshow, it might answer some questions.
Yes, we have questions from Representative Thompson and then Carpenter, and then after that we will go to the slideshow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some of the same comments as Representative Rasmussen has, and I received four or five different emails and calls saying, you know, that this is a bad idea during this period of recovery for Alaska from the down that we've had for the last year and a half. And it's recovery time. Maybe this is a year early. Maybe next year we should look at this and agree to it. But right now I feel like this is going to hurt our economy when it shouldn't. And this is a bad idea at this time, I think.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I get the fairness argument. It makes sense to me in the business community when you're dealing with government taxation, and that you would want a fair playing field in the environment. I'm wondering if we would just consider that maybe in the interest of making it fair for businesses that we adjust the rental car tax to meet the Turo tax.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. We'll go to the slideshow. Ms. Carrick?
For the record, Ashley Carrick, staff to Representative Wohl. Some of this is review from what Representative Wohl has introduced. However, there's a couple of points that have come up in conversation that perhaps the slides can clarify. So first off, just on slide 2, we're looking at a couple of definitions that are in the bill. A vehicle rental business is currently what we would call a car rental business in statute. These cover traditional car rentals or peer-to-peer rentals. So this includes Alamo, Enterprise, Turo, Getaround, etc. There's also vehicle rental networks, and this is the digital network, the software, and applications used to conduct a vehicle rental business, such as the app platform that Turo uses. So just to clarify a couple of definitions off the top. And on slide 3, we're looking at states where the Department of Revenue in that state has said, or released some sort of position statement, that these types of companies, these vehicle rental networks, Turo is one, there are others, there's one called Getaround, and then there's a few for RV rentals as well. I just want to note here that there are 16 states which have determined these businesses to be taxable. Alaska's Department of Revenue during the Walker administration did have a position statement on this. They currently do not have a position statement on it in this administration. However, I would note that we did ask for a alleged legal opinion on whether our current vehicle rental tax could be applied to vehicle rental networks, and their position was yes. Our current statute does is broad enough that they could be applied. However, we believe that this bill helps provide further clarity in statute. By adding vehicle rental networks, we're not just saying that Enterprise and Avis have to pay. We're saying that app-based companies also have to pay into the Alaska vehicle rental tax system. And just another note here, as Representative Wohl mentioned, there was an ordinance in Anchorage which was passed just this last July, which had begun to collect tax on peer-to-peer rentals, applying an 8% tax on both vehicle rentals through traditional companies and peer-to-peer networks. And in doing so, they added a new definition for a hosting platform. On this next slide, the states where vehicle rental networks are collecting tax and remitting that back to the state. There are 29 states which currently do this. And we have covered Alaska's current vehicle tax rates, but as a review, it's 10% for motor vehicles and 3% for RVs. And historically, the vehicle rental tax revenue for the state of Alaska has been around $10 million. The reason why our office has estimated approximately a 10 to 30% addition in revenue is just looking at the number of rentals available, not just through Turo, but through other platforms as well, and giving a rough estimate. However, it's really important to note here that in 2018, the Department of Revenue, again under the Walker administration, filed a lawsuit against Turo specifically because in trying to collect vehicle rental tax, that particular app-based business would not provide information about who was renting and conducting business in Alaska, and they wouldn't provide even basic contact information to get in touch with owners of vehicles to collect tax. So this is a rough estimate. We don't know on, like Representative Wohl mentioned, we can look for a specific day on Turo in a specific city if there are vehicles available. When you limit that search, as we did just this afternoon, to a week-long rental available in Anchorage, there weren't too many vehicles that came up, but at any given time, that can shift and change. And the main point to make here is, as a state, we don't currently know how many people are renting through a platform such as Turo, and we don't know how much money they're making either.
Thank you, Ms. Carrick. I'd just like the record to reflect at 3:37 p.m. we were joined by Representative Edgman.
Thank you. Again, through the chair, on this next slide, the main argument to be made here related to peer-to-peer networks is that they are operating under the same business model as a traditional car rental company, but they're not paying into our state's economy similarly. They rent vehicles. They provide insurance protection for the owners of vehicles. They do sell ancillary products, and the owners of vehicles can rent out a GPS, for example, car seats, offer those services. And Enterprise, as well as peer-to-peer networks, have app-based technology that help consumers to access these rentals. So we're looking at similar business models with different tax burdens. Again, this would not be applying the tax to the owner of the vehicle renting through the platform. Would be applying that tax to the person renting the vehicle from the vehicle owner. And again, this business model aligns as well with other app-based industries such as Airbnb and Uber. And when we hear from app-based industry companies, or I believe there's a few internet-based companies which have broad opposition against any sort of taxation burdens being applied to app-based companies as well as traditional companies, whether we're talking about Turo versus a traditional rental car company, or Uber versus a taxi cab, Airbnb versus a hotel. It's often a similar argument. But what we do know is that peer-to-peer networks are clearly operating in Alaska. They may not have brick and mortar, but they are here. They are operating. They are making money off of Alaskans. And additionally, we do have another opinion from Legislative Legal, which says that these peer-to-peer networks are liable to pay this tax. And at this time, if there's any further questions, we'd be happy to take them.
Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I have a creative question. So I have a friend who has a 10-bedroom B&B business. and I purchase an additional vehicle and I lease that vehicle to my friend's bed and breakfast business on a flat rate of $50 per day, whether they rent it or not, it's just available to the B&B. So if the B&B sells their rooms or rents their rooms with an additional, hey, they're first come, first serve, there's a vehicle available for use by our guests of the B&B, is that vehicle outside all of this because it's part of a bed and breakfast business, and am I outside it because I have a lease flat rate, whether it's rented or not? Does anybody pay a tax on using that vehicle as part of a bed and breakfast?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, I'm not a lawyer. Never have been. The state law currently says if you rent a vehicle through any application or any mechanism, you're liable for the tax. Now, most of that isn't collected because we don't know who's renting these cars. So you lease the car to your friend with the Airbnb. I think technically you're renting your car. Maybe lease is different than rent, and that's where the whole legal argument comes in. But I think if you're making money through from someone using your car, you're in the car rental business. But the state, that was the problem the state had earlier. There's all these Uber renters, and technically they're liable for this tax, but it's hard to discover them all. The state asked Uber who they were. Uber said, we're not going to tell you. Someone said, well, the only way to get at them is to tax Uber as a whole. And I just want to add one point about taxation and fairness. And first of all, Airbnb does pay the bed tax. So although you may say, well, Airbnb is cheaper because they're exempt from these taxes, they're not. So whoever owns houses that rents Airbnb is somehow dealing with it, and they're able to stay solvent. And I have many friends that rent out their houses for Airbnb or have an extra cabin or have a room, and there's a local bed tax they pay in Fairbanks, but guess what? They're still in business, and they're still doing quite well. The other thing I will add is many communities, and I forget the name of the law that passed, that allows taxes to be applied to online sales. So if you have the Mayfair case. So if you're in a state or a city that has a sales tax and you buy something online from a non-brick and mortar store, guess what? You got to pay that sales tax to your local municipality. And that has saved so many communities during this pandemic because people are staying at home, they're not going shopping, they're buying everything online. And there was a lot, and the revenue gained from that online sales tax has actually helped many, many local economies. So this is sort of in parallel with that. Oh, I can't go to the shoe store anymore. I can't go to the whatever store. Now I can just buy it online, but they're still going to pay the tax that the local municipality will still receive. And it's working well. And that's what this is. That's all it is. It's not punishing anyone. It's just making everyone pay the same tax. And I argue that whoever owns a car and is renting it out and has to pay the state sales tax, who has to apply the state sales tax to the renter, can still stay in business just fine.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess follow up to that odd question for me. I guess if the use of the vehicle is built into the B&B business model and the B&B was paying a bed tax to the local community, I guess indirectly there would be tax collected on that vehicle. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, the state has a rental car tax. That bill, I think, was put in the late 80s, maybe early 90s. And in that bill, in statute, it says that that revenue will go to the travel industry to advertise travel to the lower 48 or wherever, you know. And I'm just wondering, is this going to have a similar thing if we're going to force them to be collecting state tax? Is that subject to 100% going to the travel industry, even though we have not ever gave the travel industry 1 cent after that says it in statute?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, this vehicle rental tax will be treated like all other vehicle rental tax, whether they apply it to that statutory designation is probably up to this committee as much as anything else.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Representative Wolf. So is it revenue's position that essentially these networks are evading the tax right now?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, right now the Department of Revenue does not have a position on this bill or on whether private vehicle rentals should be taxed. The previous administration did have that position, however, and Ledge Legal, when we asked, should Turo, as for example, as a business conducting revenue transactions in Alaska, have a business license? Their opinion was yes, they should have a business license.
And follow up?
I think you've answered it. It's the third slide where you say 16 states, including Alaska, have a revenue department which has determined. All right, I guess I misread that. Essentially, with this bill, the networks would have to play ball. They could no longer avoid not declaring who their subscribers were. That's the essence of it.
Yeah, to the Church Representative Josephson, just a comment that this bill merely adds clarity, or if we could say even teeth, to statute that already exists. This makes it very, very clear that the legislature, if passed, intends that vehicle rental networks should pay the tax.
Thank you. I see no further questions. We will move to public testimony. I'm opening public testimony. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on House Bill 90? Seeing none, we will move online. First in Seattle, Washington, with Internet Association, is Rose Feliciano. Ms. Feliciano, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your two-minute testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Merrick and members of the committee. My name is Rose Feliciano. I'm the Northwest Director for State Government Affairs for Internet Association. IA represents over 40 of the world's leading internet-based companies. Today, I am here to respectfully oppose HB 90. As I pointed out in my letter, peer-to-peer car sharing is fundamentally different from legacy car rental companies and should not be treated as such. One of the big differences is that peer-to-peer car sharing is the company does not own the cars that are made available on the platform. Those cars are owned by regular people who make their cars available. Many times it is to earn a little extra cash or to pay down a car loan quicker. And as Representative Wool has noted, there are some folks who are able to get, two cars and make them available, and it helps them make some nice income. As tourism comes back, I am not sure why you would want to put a tax on a service that helps bolster tourism. As you have seen many reports, there is a shortage of rental cars, and P2P hopes to fill that gap. If this bill passes, it would make it impossible, if not difficult, for hosts to offer their cars, which would hurt tourism. I will also note that I'm not sure exactly on the tax slides that were presented are completely accurate. I live in Washington State, and I know that P2P pays both sales tax on all the transactions, but they also pay the business and occupation tax. So the case that was mentioned by Representative Wool Wayfair, if a state has a sales tax, the peer-to-peer do charge a sales tax for every transaction.
Ms. Feliciano?
And I know each state is different in their tax models, and so it makes it a little bit complicated.
Thank you. Your 2 minutes is...
One of the things that is disappointing is that the peer-to-peer platforms were not invited to have a conversation and provide meaningful input in the crafting of the regulation.
Ms. Feliciano,
I think that
your 2 minutes has expired.
It shows that it doesn't understand the business model, and it may not achieve what its desired intent is. What we've seen in Anchorage is that they have put the bill forward. There was no industry input, and it is now not resulting in the tax revenues that it thought it would achieve.
Ms. Feliciano?
I would suggest you
consider, ma'am, I'm sorry, your 2 minutes has expired, but I do have a question for you. This is Representative Merrick. You mentioned that there's a shortage of rental cars, you know, in the United States, I guess. If all the rental cars are taken, wouldn't Turo be a good second choice? If there are no rental cars, wouldn't the business go to Turo?
I think that the peer-to-peer car sharing is a good second choice for certainly in a car rental shortage. But also rental car companies have restrictions on how you can use your cars. And if I get a car from Turo, I might be able to go off-road in that, which I wouldn't be able to if I got something from Enterprise.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today. Next up in California with Enterprise is Benjamin Palmer. Mr. Palmer, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your 2-minute testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to express our support. For the record, Benjamin Palmer, Director of Government and Public Affairs for Enterprise Holdings. We're a privately held, family-owned company with the Enterprise Alamo National Brands. We've been operating Alaska since 1989, recruit recent college graduates, find ways to give back to the community where we can, and are very happy to be here in Alaska. HB 90 clarifies Alaska's rental car tax applies to rentals regardless of how they're rented, either through traditional brick-and-mortar branches or peer-to-peer or other online platforms. As I stated previously, the tax is paid by the renter, and it's something that all customers in the state of Alaska should expect when renting a car. The bill will create a level playing field and ensure that the state's general fund does not lose out on income owed on these transactions. I appreciate your time and here to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. I see no questions from the committee. Next, in Anchorage, we have Mark Ha. Mr. Ha, if you could please state your name, affiliation, and begin your 2-minute testimony.
Yes, hello. My name is Mark Ha, and I'm just a guy. I'm in the Airbnb business, and I have some friends that are in Turo, and they weren't able to join with me on this call, but wanted me to say a few words. I know for a fact that, you know, I'm not with a big company or the big industry. I'm just the guy on the street here. My friends make supplemental income from renting out their cars, and in fact, one of the folks has a guy that works out of town and doesn't use the car for some time, and while he's not using it, his wife will use a Turo system to earn some extra income. One of the things that I do know is that the big industries, the car rental folks, they have all these wholesale opportunities to buy their cars at great prices. They have all these tax breaks, and I'm sure as polished as they are, they're taking advantage of all of the things that are available to lower their cost of doing business. That's not true for guy on the street. That's not true for the regular guy who's out there just trying to make a few dollars. And I just see this as an attempt for industry to really stick their hand in the guy's back pocket just to take a few dollars. And I would like to respectfully oppose House Bill 90.
Thank you, Mr. Ha. We appreciate you calling in today. Next, in San Francisco, California, with Turo is Sean Vink. If you could please state your name, affiliation, and begin your 2-minute testimony.
Good evening, Madam Chairperson, members of the committee. My name is Sean Vink. I'm senior counsel at Turo, and I'm here to respectfully oppose the legislation under consideration today, House Bill 90. To the bill, I want to address a few points that may not have been fully addressed earlier. in the committee's discussion of the bill. The first point that I would like to make is that this bill, as written, would take Alaska and make it very much out of step with the trend of states throughout the rest of the country that have comprehensively addressed peer-to-peer car sharing. Indeed, Tennessee, Arizona, West Virginia, Maryland, Virginia, Indiana, Florida, Oklahoma, and Louisiana have all within the last year enacted statutes governing peer-to-peer car sharing, and in each one of those states, a decision was made not to apply the same tax for vehicle rentals and to apply that to peer-to-peer car sharing. In other words, the claim that the emerging public policy in the country is to apply exactly the same transactional taxes to peer-to-peer car sharing and rental is simply not accurate. In fact, the bulk of the states that have addressed this issue have expressly provided for a separate and lower tax rate for peer-to-peer car sharing, declining to apply the vehicle rental excise tax to peer-to-peer car sharing because, as was discussed earlier, these are two separate industries with dramatically different business models. I also want to emphasize a point I think that came up earlier, which is that this is the imposition of a new tax. If the current tax that is provided for in Alaska did apply to these transactions, there would be no need to enact a new statute. So it's very clear that it's a new tax. I also think that the department's declination to provide support in this committee is a very telling point. The third thing that I would like to point out is that I think that rather than promote clarity, I think that the proposed legislation promotes ambiguity and confusion because it fails to address certain basic questions. Is it in fact the case that Alaska would regard every single person that allows their own vehicle to be used by another person for financial consideration? Is it really the state's position that that should be regarded as being the equivalent of a multinational rental car company?
Mr. Vink, if you could please wrap up your testimony.
Of the statute, and this bill does nothing to clarify that point. So with that, I will desist and happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a question from Representative Josephson.
To the chair, Mr. Vink, you said you listed four or five states, and you said the trend is to not apply the same tax as a traditional rental car company. So which tax do they – what tax – you wouldn't tell us what tax they apply. Tell us the amount that they apply.
Well, the taxes that – I think this was mentioned earlier, but what these states have done is they've enacted laws that exempt peer-to-peer car sharing from rental taxes. Many of these states do have marketplace facilitator statutes that apply sales and use taxes, but of course the tax that we're discussing today is not a sales and use tax because Alaska doesn't have one. This is a rental car excise tax that is an industry-specific tax, and the point that I'm raising is that the states that have addressed this issue have not seen it as the appropriate public policy to apply exactly the same total transactional taxes to peer-to-peer and rental.
Follow up?
Just a comment. Mr. Vink, I know this is your business, but I have a slide in front of me that says 29 states are currently applying a rental tax to vehicle rental networks.
I have no idea from where that information arises, so I can't comment.
Representative Wall.
Thank you. I just have a question. Assuming Turo has clients in the state and is receiving monies from those clients, does Turo have an active business license in Alaska as a corporate entity that you are? Do you have a corporate business license here in Alaska?
We do not have a corporate business license to my knowledge, but I also want to correct one thing. I don't believe that we have any, as you put it, clients. There are people that use the platform, both hosts and guests in the state of Alaska.
Representative Wool.
Well, I'm sorry if I use the wrong terminology because I know you guys, what we call renting a car, you call sharing a car. So I know words get mixed up around it here a lot. I guess my point is, if someone comes to Alaska, goes on the internet, finds a car with the Turo, through a Turo app, pays money, the owner of the car gets some, the Turo Corporation gets some of that money from a transaction that happens in Alaska. So for that reason, I believe you should have a business license in the state where you are making money. I know your company is in California or Seattle, but your transaction happened in Alaska, and that's where your money was earned. So do you not think you should have a business license in the state where you're earning your revenue?
The question is, do I think we should have a business license? Sir, the issue that we're here to address today is the proposed legislation which purports to extend a new tax onto peer-to-peer car sharing. If you'd like to have a separate discussion on questions related to the requirements of business licensure, we would be happy to follow up with you on that.
Thank you, Mr. Bink. We appreciate your testimony today. Next, in Washington, D.C., with NetChoice, is Carl Scavo. If you could please state your name, affiliation, and begin your two-minute testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Szabo. I am Vice President and General Counsel of NetChoice. I'm also an adjunct professor at the George Mason Law School. A recent headline in the Anchorage Daily News was, once worried about a budget shortfall, Alaska lawmakers face unexpected excess. And I think that kind of summarizes one of the comments made by a member a couple minutes ago. This is most definitely not the right time for any consideration of a new tax on the people of Anchorage. They're hurting, and the state right now has a budget surplus. Now, with respect to the slide regarding the 29 states, it's not entirely accurate. Most of every state on that slide is not applying a rental tax, but an excise tax to car sharing platforms like Turo. To date, for excise taxes, no state has applied the exact same rental car excise tax to peer-to-peer car sharing. Okay, rental cars are not the same as car sharing. So what was mentioned earlier is Enterprise and Hertz own hundreds of cars in dozens of locations in Alaska. Turo doesn't own a single one. But one of the things that the citizen who called in mentioned are some of the exemptions that are being handed out. Now, we heard the Department of Revenue announce that the state earns $10 million annual from rental cars. But believe it or not, Hertz, Enterprise, and other rental car companies actually enjoy a $1.9 million windfall payback, which can be found on line 25. This is the vehicle license cost recovery fee that is applied only for Enterprise and other rentals, but not to your citizens when they share their cars. Finally, one of the things, if this is just merely a clarification, that means that you are suggesting that it should be applied retroactively. I ask if the Department of Revenue is now going to seek out every citizen who has not yet paid these taxes because essentially it didn't exist. If the argument is that you are not seeking retroactive fees, then it is a new tax. And
sir,
a new tax at this time is wildly inappropriate. I'm happy to answer any other questions and also address unconstitutionality issues and many other problems with this legislation.
Thank you very much. This is Representative Merrick, and I would just like to make a clarification. It is my understanding that there's a surplus before a dividend is paid. So if we pay a permanent fund dividend this year, we'll likely be in a deficit. Representative Josephson.
Yes, Professor, I'm troubled when you talk about this not being the right time for a tax, because it must beg the question, are you an equal opportunity testifier? Have you ever testified before a legislative body, ladies and gentlemen, this is the right time for a tax? Have you ever so testified?
Madam Chair, so with respect to the question, I'm actually racking my brain because typically, I am not in favor of new taxes, and I'm certainly not in favor of taxes that are designed to attack an industry that is wildly different. So if we are to apply taxes fairly and evenly, then you can't apply the tax that you use for rental cars to car sharing because they are not the same. So to the extent that, A, I don't know if I've ever actually supported a tax in public testimony, but B, to the point where all taxes should be applied fairly and equally, this is certainly not a fair or equal application of tax.
Representative Josephson.
Follow up through the chair. Professor, are you associated with the Mercatus Center at George Mason or just the Antonin Scalia Law School?
Madam Chair, just the Antonin Scalia Law School.
Thank you very much, Mr. Szabo. We appreciate you coming to testify today. I see no one else online to testify. So with that, I will close public testimony. Next, we're going to review the fiscal notes. First will be fiscal note number 2 from the Tax Division, control code VFSEW. We have Nicole Reynolds, Deputy Director. If you could please place yourself on the record and review your fiscal note.
Good afternoon. This is Nicole Reynolds, Deputy Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. Through the chair, the department has submitted an indeterminate fiscal note. As stated previously, there's just an insufficient amount of recorded and reliable data out there for the department to estimate the revenue impact of expanding the taxpayer base. So we don't have that information. But we do have an expectation that this bill would have a positive effect on revenue collections.
Thank you, Ms. Reynolds. And is the reason that you don't have sufficient information is because the peer-to-peer companies or peer-to-peer sharing vehicles are not disclosing that information?
That's correct.
Thank you. Questions from the committee regarding fiscal note number 2? I see none. Thank you, Ms. Reynolds, for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next up will be fiscal note number 1 from Division of Motor Vehicles, control code NFCCU. We have Jeffrey Schmitz, Director of the DMV online. Mr. Schmitz, please put yourself on the record and review your fiscal note.
Hello, committee members. My name is Jeffrey Schmitz, for the record. I'm the Director for Alaska DMV. Madam Chair, committee members, with respect to the fiscal note, the fiscal note that was submitted for this is a zero fiscal note, as it does not affect DMV in any way. So that's what's submitted.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Schmitz. Are there any questions? Seeing none, we appreciate you being with us today. Are there any further questions or comments? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I understand the pushback from internet companies and companies that want to keep the internet transactions cheaper than sort of brick and mortar transactions. And some of these people that are called in are from, you know, Internet Incorporated or sort of these vast nondescript entities. But I just want to reiterate, and I carried the Uber bill several years ago, and I got a lot of friction, understandably so, on different aspects of the bill. But nonetheless, it passed, and we have Uber in the state of Alaska. And I'm one that says, you get a taxi, you get an Uber. It's not that different. One you get through your phone, and one you might hail on the street. But now you can hail a taxi on your phone, and the industries have sort of come together in a lot of ways. Bottom line is, you get in a car, you pay them some money, they take you somewhere. Airbnb, not a hotel experience, but essentially you're paying someone to use a bed and a bathroom and so on in their house. It's a place to stay. Online sales, now municipalities can charge a sales tax, whether you buy it at the local store or whether you buy it online. These are equal all across the board. I mean, some things about it are different, but at the end of the day, you know, you got a taxi ride, you got a place to stay, and you bought a pair of shoes. At the end of the day, it's all the same thing. And I put out there that this is the same. I need a car for a week. Someone meets me at the airport. They give me the keys. I drive around. At the end of the week, I meet them back at the airport. I give them the keys back, and I pay some money. It's essentially the same service. And I think the tax should apply equally. And if you have an Uber ride in Juneau, you pay the same sales tax as if you had a taxi. No one wanted to make it less. If you get an Airbnb, no one said, geez, that bed tax should be slightly less for this homeowner than it is for Westmark Hotel. So I think it should apply the same. Is there a good time to apply a tax? I don't know. Hopefully we have a bunch of tourists coming up here this summer and they'll need cars. No one's talking about reducing the cruise ship head tax, are we? Because that's a well-established head tax, and hopefully we'll get cruise ships back. Are they gonna be as full? No. Is the economy strained? Yes, but no one's saying, hey, let's reduce that tax because now's not a good time. No, people will pay the tax, they'll come up here. And I feel the same way for the rental cars. They are right now liable for the rental tax. However, we have no way of collecting it. And I don't want to try to find every individual in the state of Alaska. It's easier to find the company that facilitates it, the company that doesn't have a business license in this state for some strange reason, and does make money off Alaskans and people coming to Alaska. So I believe this tax should be flat across the board. The other rental car companies have brick and mortars. They pay rent, they pay employees, they create jobs. These ones provide income to private individuals. I applaud it. I think it's great. If I had a car that I could rent out on Turo, I very well may do it. But I'd be happy to charge my customer that extra 10% tax that should go to the state. And we certainly could use the revenue. And I know some individual called up and told us what we should be doing with our fiscal crisis, a gentleman from Washington or somewhere like that. But I think we're the ones that should decide what to do with our fiscal crisis. And if we can bring in $3 or $4 million extra dollars, I'm sure we'll find a way to spend it. So that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wohl. I see nothing else from the committee. We will set House Bill 90 aside and bring it up at a future hearing. Amendments will be due to my office by Saturday, May 15th at 6 p.m. for House Bill 90. Next on our agenda, thank you, Representative Wohl and Ms. Carrick.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next on our agenda is Senate Bill 55, Employer Contributions to PERS by the Office of Management and Budget. I will plan to look to the will of the committee after this discussion. We have Mr. Steiniger from Office of Management and Budget. If you could place yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, Neil Steiniger, Office of Management and Budget. And I'd like to say also online, I believe I have Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer with Department of Administration, who can provide a lot more detail on the PERS program as well as the history of the program if the committee desires. So thank you for hearing Senate Bill 55 this afternoon, Employer Contributions to PERS. So a little bit about this bill. It seeks to remove the cap on public employer retirement system payroll contributions made by the state of Alaska as an employer. There's a couple of things that this does. It continues to fully fund the state's obligation to the PERS system. It also applies only to the state of Alaska and does not impact other PERS employers. It's for the PERS system only and does not impact the teachers' retirement system. It does not impact retiree or active employee benefits or the amount that active employees pay into retirement. And it does not reduce overall employer contributions to PERS. What it does do, however, is by removing the cap on employer contributions to the PERS system for the state of Alaska, it allows the state to share some of those costs with federal programs and other sources, thereby reducing our general fund expenditures for PERS payments by about $25.7 million in fiscal year 22. So a little bit of background on Alaska's retirement obligations. In fiscal year 20, the PERS unfunded liability was estimated to be about $4.6 billion. The way we pay down that unfunded liability is through a contribution of effectively three different sources of money. Employer contributions, which are 22% of employee salaries, these are paid for the state with a mix of fund sources, unrestricted general fund, federal funds, other designated general funds. There's on behalf payments for municipalities and other PERS employers, though they're paid with 100% unrestricted general fund. Those represent the difference between those employer contributions of 22% of payroll on the employee salaries and the total actuarial cost of this unfunded liability. And there's also an on-behalf payment made for State of Alaska as an employer. This is the amount not charged to State of Alaska payroll that is funded with 100% unrestricted general fund in the state's operating budget. This bill seeks to address this third piece of the way that we pay for our unfunded liability, the portion for the state of Alaska as an employer. So the 22% rate and the 22% cap, it was set in 2008 when the legislature established a uniform rate for payroll contributions for all PERS employers. This was part of bringing all the different PERS employers under one rate, under one pooling of these resources. That 22% cap is less than the actuarial contribution required to pay that unfunded liability. On an annual basis, we calculate that liability. For fiscal year 22, it's 30.11% of payroll. So there's that difference of 8.11% between the cap and the actuarial liability. In fiscal year 22, that portion, that difference, is $193.5 million in unrestricted general funds paid in the language section of the operating budget. $95.7 million of that amount is the amount for the state on behalf of itself as an employer. The remaining $97.8 million is made on behalf of the other 153 active PERS employers. So those would be your municipalities and school districts throughout the state. So you put a little bit of visual to this concept. This shows current law. State contribution to payroll, or state payroll contribution to retirement, is about $246 million, and that's a 22% of payroll. We then make the $95.8 million on behalf payment with unrestricted general fund. Here you can see that that payroll contribution is broken up into several different fund categories, UGF, DGF, other, and federal receipts. And the current law, the total amount paid for our retirement obligation for state employees is $342.4 million, or $0.2 million. 202, or 59% of it, is coming from unrestricted general fund. And this is the current state. By uncapping the 22% and allowing the full 30.11% to be charged to state payroll, we still pay the total contribution. However, because we can now apply that 30.11% to these other fund sources, we don't see the commensurate increase in UGF that you did on the prior slide. So you can see under the proposed law, the total UGF is $176.4 million, or roughly 50% of the total $349.8 million cost, a net reduction of $25.7 million in unrestricted general fund cost to meet this same obligation. One thing to note about this estimate and the way that this gets implemented is that we don't see all the savings for this effort in year one. So the $25.7 million is an estimate for year one, but that's far reduced from what the savings would look like if we could fully implement in the first year. And the reason for that is as we charge indirect costs, such as contributions to the PERS system, to federal programs, we have to provide those federal programs with reports and justifications for those costs. And different programs are on different schedules for how we provide them information on the cost allocation, or the way that we charge indirect costs to the programs. Some federal agencies will allow us to make this change in the first year. Some federal agencies will take 1, 2, or 3 years for us to actually implement these changes. And the reason for that is the way that we interact with those federal agencies to justify the costs on those federal programs. There are still yet some federal agencies that have a cap on the amount that we charge for those grants, and so we won't be able to see the benefit there. However, as we've gone through the analysis with various federal programs that the state interacts with and charges money to for payroll, we found that we could offset those costs with unrestricted general fund to ensure those programs don't get harmed and still see the net $25.7 million in savings. But over the next several years, as state agencies renegotiate and reapply for these cost allocation agreements with federal partners, they will be able to implement this change to the payroll contribution over time, and we should see that savings number increase in out years.
Representative Josephson.
Given that this slide deck is so short, can I ask a question?
You certainly can.
Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, and you may have just answered this, but fundamentally what I want to make sure of is if an agency receives $100 million from its federal sister agency or whatever as a match or grant, this bill wouldn't turn that into $105 million, right? In other words, we still get just whatever we got under federal law as a match, $100 million in my hypothetical. And does that mean that the service provided on the ground in Alaska would be lessened? Because whatever we're providing as a service in myriad ways is now going to be part of the PERS liability.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's an excellent question and something that we worked on through production of the fiscal note. And so in your example of a fixed dollar grant from the federal government of $100 million, if that set grant amount cannot be adjusted for changes in costs such as this, then we wouldn't be able to collect additional money from that federal grant. So as we put together the fiscal note for this, we wanted to be sure to identify programs like that, that have a fixed dollar value grant from the federal government, and ensure that as we apply this payroll cost, this cost to payroll, that we're not hampering the ability of the agency to perform the work under that grant. And so the way that we accommodated that is as we spoke with agencies and they identified these programs, we adjusted our fiscal note, the general fund savings on our fiscal note down by applying unrestricted general fund in those areas where federal receipts couldn't be collected. And the reason that we were able to do that and add unrestricted general fund to the fiscal note without hampering our ability to save money is that currently the full amount of this cost is paid with unrestricted general fund. So any place where we can't apply this, we simply revert back to kind of current practice of covering this cost with some restricted general fund. But the policy change allows us in cases where we have a $100 million grant, but it can be increased if costs go up to capture those additional federal revenues and apply them to this cost.
Follow up?
Yes, I think fundamentally what I'm hearing is that there's been a lost opportunity over the years, and we're trying to capture that opportunity and benefit from it. And it's sort of that simple. That's fundamentally what I'm hearing.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's correct.
Thank you. Please continue.
So slide 7 is showing the budget impact to state agencies. One thing to note about this change is that we're shifting a $100 million cost, roughly $100 million cost, from the language section of the operating budget, where it's not recorded against any individual program or department, and moving it into the state personal services line where state employee payroll is reflected. And so that will appear as a roughly $100 million increase in all funds to state agency payroll. But it's important to note that that's not actually an increase to payroll. It's not an increase to the number of employees. It's simply shifting a cost from one area of the budget to another. This slide is trying to show where those costs will land in each agency. And much more detail is available on this if you want to see by budgetary component or program. We can provide that information, and that information has been provided to legislative finance. There also should be a handout in your packets that gives you this information, but with a little bit more detail about those offsets that I was speaking to earlier and that Representative Josephson was alluding to in his question, where we had to make changes from the base projection, the kind of, if you will, sort of perfect projection where we're able to capture every single federal dollar, where we've had to walk some of that back with our conversations with departments about various programs. And you can see where those adjustments have been made in the sort of larger handout.
On the slide.
Representative Josephson.
Sure, Mr. Steininger. looking at slide 7 in the commerce line, would that result in increased professional license fees because commerce sets those fees and would have to cover those costs?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is one area where in implementation they would have to recalculate fees based on this cost when they look at, you know, what the cost of the labor in that program is. So that is another area where, as we looked at the implementation and looked at areas where there are fees dependent on the cost of state employee payroll, that we worked with the departments to determine, is this an area where either current fee collections could accommodate this increased cost without adjustment to the fee, or, you know, what that implementation timeline that made sense for the individual program could be accommodated. And we worked that into the fiscal note and worked with the agencies to ensure that the implementation of this change wouldn't result in excessive changes to any kind of fees or, you know, any wouldn't be problematic in the implementation of their programs.
Thank you. Please continue.
So slide 8 is illustrating the history of this on behalf payment or state assistance payment rate. Or really, it's illustrating the actuarial rate of our PERS contributions. The on behalf or state assistance portion is the difference between the blue line at 22% and the orange line representing the actuarial rate. So it's the difference between those two lines that we're looking to address with this policy change. But you can also see that there is some variability in this amount. So at the far right-hand side of the graph, you have the current year with the 30.11% actuarial rate. But you can see at its peak, it was 35.84. So one thing in the kind of current standard is that you see this on behalf payment, the state assistance payment, in the language section of the budget go up and down year to year with this actuarial rate. If SB 55 is enacted, some of this variability will move into the personal services line of state agency operating budgets. And that's an important thing to consider, especially as a finance committee. In future years, you will see salary adjustment change records or, you know, personal service adjustment change records to accommodate this variability. In the current system, you see that variability happen in the language section. It simply will shift to agency operating budgets. So that's just one thing to know. It's not really a change in what's currently happening in terms of the overall budget. It's just a change in where you'll see it and where it will appear in budget documents.
Thank you, Mr. Seiniger. Seeing no questions, we will move to public, Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think I know the answer to this, but the on-behalf payment, 95.7 is paid by the state. The remaining 97.8 is made on behalf of the other 53 other active PERS employers. I'm assuming that's like municipalities and those types of entities. Would this change anything for them?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, you're correct in that that is the, you know, municipalities, school districts that have PERS employees. And but no, this change does not impact them. One piece of this was to ensure that we limited the focus of this change to where there is financial benefit for the state. So since the state has a lot of state employees that have salaries paid for by federal sources, there is a benefit to the state. The same benefit wouldn't exist with municipalities or other PERS employers. So keeping the 22% cap, you know, keeps their costs the same. And it's important to ensure that because they won't see a benefit from an uncapping of the 22%.
Follow-up?
No, I just want to thank you for pointing that out because we hear from them all the time. Don't raise that 22%. So.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, we'll go to public testimony. I'm opening public testimony. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 55? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Mr. Seiniger, it looks like we have three fiscal notes. If you could begin with fiscal note number 5. Division of Retirement and Benefits, control code KQFNW.
Mm-hmm. Chair Merrick, fiscal note number 5 was prepared by Retirement and Benefits. This fiscal note is the actuarial fiscal note. Since this bill does impact the PERS system, it's required to have an actuarial fiscal note. You'll see in fiscal year 23 a $200,000 additional cost. The reason for this is in the current system, the state assistance payment is made in a lump sum at the beginning of the fiscal year. By moving that to the personal services line, it will be made with payroll. So it'll be made on a monthly basis. And so there is a little bit of an investment loss by not having a lump sum at the beginning of the year. So the pension system does earn slightly less money because they're getting the money throughout the year rather than in a lump sum. However, when we review the other fiscal notes, you'll see that this $207 cost is significantly less than the state general fund savings.
Thank you. Are there questions regarding fiscal note number 5? Seeing none, we'll go to fiscal note number 4, OMB control code BJKQJ.
Chair Merrick, fiscal note number 4, prepared by the Office of Management and Budget, is a consolidation of many budget transactions in every place where there is a state employee within the budget. And this is an aggregate of applying this 8.11% to get to the 30.11% cost for PERS contributions to state employee payroll. And you can see the mix of fund sources in fiscal year 22, the distribution of the roughly $100 million in cost.
Are there questions regarding fiscal note number 4? Seeing none, fiscal note number 3, OMB, control code IFPHX.
Thank you. Fiscal note number 3 was also prepared by the Office of Management and Budget. This reflects the reduction to the language section of the operating budget where the state assistance payment is made. And you know, this reflects that reduction, which was added back in fiscal note number 4.
Thank you. Are there questions regarding fiscal note number 3? Are there questions regarding Senate Bill 55? Seeing none, I'd like to thank your office for your work on finding these cost savings. This is something that you know, we really appreciate here in the House Finance Committee. With that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Seeing no further questions on Senate Bill 55, Representative Rasmussen, do I have a motion?
Madam Co-Chair, I move Senate Bill 55, version 32-GS1684-A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Hearing no objection, Senate Bill 55 is moved from committee. Seeing nothing further to come before the committee, this concludes our agenda. Our next meeting is tomorrow, where we will hear House Bill 163, Form of Signature on Vehicle Title, by Representative Shragi. So with that, at 4:33 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you.